From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We've entered the dog days of summer, usually a slow news time. Turns out that it's not so slow right now, which is awkward for us because this is one of maybe 2 weeks in the year that we assemble the show entirely from pieces that have previously aired. It's a week when we both take a break, but it also gives us the chance to revisit some of our favorite material, stuff that still resonates with us and, we hope, with you.
So we're sticking to the plan, starting with a very current issue and one of our favorite guests, author and University of Chicago law professor Jeffrey Stone. His book, called Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, chronicles White House efforts to squelch the press from the Sedition Act of 1798 right on through the War on Terrorism. Much has happened since we first discussed the book in December 2004, so Stone will return in a few minutes to update us. But first, he explains how he organized his book around the six moments in American history when free speech took a hit. He said it always happened in time of war, or something like war.
First was when the United States was on the verge of war with France. 1798, the Federalists made it a crime for any person to criticize the government, the Congress, or the president. During the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus, which resulted in the detention of many individuals for their dissent. During World War I, Woodrow Wilson enacted legislation that made it a crime to criticize the war or the draft. During World War II, although the primary civil liberties issues was the internment of Japanese Americans, the Roosevelt administration also attempted to denaturalize and deport individuals who were deemed American fascists. During the Cold War, the United States slipped into a frenzy in which tens of thousands of Americans were humiliated, were exposed, were fired, were blacklisted, and were prosecuted for their political beliefs. And during the Vietnam War, the Nixon administration engaged in widespread surveillance of political anti-war organizations and attempted to intimidate and harass those organizations.
Let's go back to 1798. And the first person ever to have been jailed under the Sedition Act was a man named Matthew Lyon.
Right. Lyon was a congressman from Vermont. He was a frontiersman, a very much self-made man. He was opposed to the Federalists, who tended to be much more upper crust than the Republicans of Jefferson and Madison. And Lyon was eventually prosecuted for giving a speech in which he accused the Adams administration of being concerned primarily with its own pomp and its own ridiculous self-importance. And for that, he was sentenced to prison.
Basically, his crime is that he had a big mouth, but no lack of patriotism.
Oh, exactly right. Many of the characters in this book were individuals who had deeply felt and passionate political views that were not within the mainstream, views that in many instances eventually came to be accepted. And we're very much in debt for their persistence, their stubbornness, and their insistence on continuing to express their views, even over the efforts of the government to suppress them.
Now, the most cinematic character in your book is probably Molly Steimer, who wasn't allowed to stay anywhere very long by dint of the fact that she couldn't keep her mouth shut.
Yeah, she was my favorite character in all of this 200 years of history. Steimer arrived in the United States as an immigrant from Russia. Immediately upon arriving, she found work in a factory. She began reading and was curious and became, over time, a trade unionist and eventually an admirer of Emma Goldman and Bakunin. During World War I, she opposed the United States' participation in the war. She was arrested and prosecuted for essentially encouraging opposition to the war. Finally, in the early 1920s, the government decided to deport her to the Soviet Union. And at that time, there was a railroad strike, and Molly Steimer refused to leave her prison cell because she refused to ride on a train, which was being operated by scabs. After the strike finally ended, she was sent to the Soviet Union. The Russian Revolution had evolved in ways that she was not happy about, and she became a vehement protester against the Soviet government. After several years, she was deported then from the Soviet Union to Germany, being, so far as I know, the only person in history ever to be deported both from the United States and from the Soviet Union. She was a quite remarkable person. I mean, Molly Steimer was 4'9" tall. She weighed about 90 pounds, and she was as determined and fierce and deeply committed to her principles as anyone in American history.
Now, of the six eras of unfree speech that you talk about in your book, you pick out three as the most egregious. What were they?
Well, the period of the Sedition Act of 1798, World War I, and the Cold War were by far the most egregious. And what made them so extreme is that in each of those instances, politicians and or government officials went out of their way to exploit and to use opportunistically the natural fear and anxiety that is produced in any wartime situation. So in 1798, the Federalists attempted to take advantage of the impending war with France to enact legislation that would enable them to try to put the Republican Party of Jefferson and Madison entirely out of business by prosecuting anyone who was critical of the Adams administration.
Now, in the other two cases, basically you say the same pernicious forces at work, that the principal aim of suppressing free speech wasn't necessarily to increase the security of the country, but simply to repress a voice that would question the people in power. In other words, partisan voices.
Exactly right. So during the Cold War, for instance, Republicans like Joseph McCarthy and Richard Nixon saw the opportunity to use the Red Card as a way to rally Americans to take advantage of their fear, to exacerbate their fear, and therefore to essentially say that you cannot trust the Democrats. The Democrats are not adequately protecting us against the Red Menace. Only Republicans can do that for you. During World War I, President Wilson led the United States into a war where we had not been attacked, and he therefore faced the problem of both creating an outraged public that would be willing to make the sacrifices that war demands and also attempting to turn people against those who would be dissenting, because there were many individuals who opposed our entry into the war because, in fact, we hadn't been attacked.
Where do you think the Bush administration stacks up during the War on Terror to these other epochs?
Well, certainly the Bush administration has reacted to post-9/11 circumstances in ways that are similar to those that existed in the past. One of the primary ways that the Bush administration has attempted to shape public discourse is by controlling information and by a kind of obsessive secrecy. You control public debate by simply denying individuals access to critical information. But if one talks about the magnitude of repression, the truth is there is no real comparison. For many periods in our history, it was in fact a crime for an individual to attack the government or the conduct of a war. Certainly the speeches of people like Howard Dean and John Kerry in 2004 would have been criminal during World War I, during the Civil War in 1798, and yet that would be totally unthinkable today. But it's also the case that it's important to recognize that we have overreacted, and those overreactions matter.
As you've noted in your book, 80% of American history has not occurred in wartime. And during that 80%, people have not been jailed for expressing themselves politically. But now we are in a time, which our president has said we may not see the end of for a very long time, of permanent, amorphous war against terror. What are we to make of a time of war without end?
It's an especially dangerous one if we truly believe that it is a war without end. One consolation one can take from these historical periods is that each of them was relatively short-lived, and that once they ended, the nation saw again that it had behaved badly and, in a sense, strengthened its commitment to civil liberties. But in a situation in which one believes that this is a permanent war on terrorism, as I happen not to believe, but if one believes that, then one should be even more cautious about making these sorts of compromises because there won't be a light at the end of the tunnel.
Jeffrey Stone, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Jeffrey Stone is the Harry Calvin Jr. Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago and author of Perilous Times. So let me now bring back Jeff Stone. In recent months, we have seen greater pressure put on the media the more they disclose what the government regards as programs crucial to national security, the more pressure the media feel.
Yes, I think the administration has clearly demonized the media, to treat them as if that by disclosing knowledge about highly problematic and in some instances, in my view, illegal programs, that they are doing something that is disloyal and that undermines the national security. The calls for prosecution of the New York Times for publishing information about, for example, the NSA surveillance program by officials as high up as Attorney General Gonzalez is one that has to cause a great deal of lost sleep within the upper reaches of the Times. There's never been in the history of the United States a criminal prosecution of the media for publishing information that the government wanted to keep confidential. And the fact that the administration is rattling its sabers about such an issue has to send some shockwaves to the media.
When the media do get in trouble with the government, they tend to find some relief in the courts. And that seems to be less and less a safe haven for the free press.
Well, on the one hand, because of the makeup of the courts today, the vast majority of federal judges have been appointed by Republican presidents, and 7 of the 9 Supreme Court justices have been appointed by Republican presidents. And for that reason, the courts are probably less sympathetic to an aggressive interpretation of the freedom of the press than otherwise might be the case. But I think what the Supreme Court has demonstrated is that they have learned, the justices have learned the lesson of history. They know that their predecessors on numerous occasions in wartime have bent over backwards to give deference to the claims of the executive about what was necessary for the national security. And they do not want it to be their own legacy that they made the same type of mistake that their predecessors did when they approved some of the measures during the McCarthy period, when they approved, for example, the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. So I think they're approaching these issues with a much more careful scrutiny, and that stood them in very good stead.
So ultimately, since you take the long view in perilous times, do you see this as a rather elastic process? Do you foresee a time in the near future when things return to what many of us regard as normal?
In every historical episode, once the crisis has passed, things have returned to normal, and more often than not, they've actually improved. I think the lessons that we will learn from what's transpired thus far since 9/11 with respect to the freedom of the press has to do with the ability of the government, of the executive branch in particular, to put into place programs that are secret. And I believe that in the end, the judgment will be that the government should not be allowed to create secret programs and that some degree of oversight, both by Congress and by the American people, is more important. And ultimately, I expect we'll see legislation to that effect.
Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke. My pleasure.
Jeffrey Stone is the Harry Calvin Jr. Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago and author of Perilous Times.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.